and welcome again to Jim Brown's Outrig Capercast of Modern Nautical Lore. This is caper number 13. We're continuing from number 12, where we were discussing some not-so-modern nautical lore.
Okay, Jimmy. So we need to know something of the ancient vessels in order to, as you say, apprehend the differences between modern watercraft types. That's cool, but it seems we can only hope you will someday get to those differences.
Yeah, that's right, you can only hope. I'm just trying to share my own understanding of this rather complicated subject with our listeners, so don't rush me now. Fundamentally, a boat is a shell that makes a hole in the surface of the water. And what keeps that shell from sinking is the weight of the water trying to rush in to fill the hole. And water is heavy, so it buoys up on the shell. And the weight of the water that would be in that hole is exactly the same as the weight of the shell and whatever's in it. And there are some boats, like the ancient Scottish curragh, that were built like a big round basket covered with hides. They made a hole in the surface of the water about like a mixing bowl. And they would carry an enormous amount of weight, but it was very difficult to make them go anywhere. Same thing is true, of course, of the modern life raft, which is round. I mean, okay, so you're not sunk, but you're not going anywhere except at drifting speed. So to make the boat go anywhere, you have to change the shape of the hole in the water. What you're trying to do is move that hole. And because water is so heavy, it doesn't like to have its hole moved very abruptly. And to relieve some of that abruptness, it helps to make the hole long and slender. Of course, if you try to move the mixing bowl very fast, it's going to pile up a wave ahead of it and drag a wave behind it. And it's actually those waves that really complicate the problem of moving the hole. Because you have to move the waves, and waves don't like to move. That is, small waves close together can only move slowly. Big waves far apart can move pretty fast, but we're not there yet. And of course, it helps to have the hole pointed on both ends. Alan Faces used to say, even a turd is pointed on both ends. So the longer and the more slender you make that hole in the ocean, well, the pointier you can make its ends, and the easier it becomes to push that heavy water out of the way in order to move the hole, and move it at something faster than drifting speed. In the preceding caper, I spoke admiringly of the dugout canoe, the hollowed log, and it was very fortunate that that technology was given in the log. That is, the shape of the thing, the shape of the canoe, had to be pretty much the shape of the log. So the hole that it made in the surface was long and narrow. It didn't make waves. But the thing was relatively unstable. It is tippy, easy to rock from side to side. Now, ancient man seldom used dugouts for crossing big pieces of open water, but believe me, there was a lot of longshore or coastal seafaring done in dugout canoes, maybe more than we will ever know. Now, I've spent a fair bit of time in dugouts, and I must say that I think their marine architecture is quite brilliant, and for this reason, the native people allow them to sit in the water enough to soak up in the bottom of the bilge of the canoe. That is, the bottom of the boat is carved so as to be fairly thick, maybe even 3 inches thick. And when it soaks up with water, it becomes heavy when you try to take it out of the water, particularly when the boat is rolled from one side to the other. You begin to roll that wet wood up into the air, and it acts as ballast, what we call now ballast. And so the dugout canoe becomes ultimately very stable, more than you'd believe. And you can also put cargo in the bilge, and you can even put rocks in the bilge. Now we're talking about ballast, the kind of ballast that is used in so many sailing vessels today. Instead of putting it in the bilge, they put it outside on the bottom of the boat. And the trouble with it, of course, is that it is always trying to make that vessel disappear from the face of the earth. It's pulling it down. If the vessel springs a leak, of course, the weight of the ballast, like rocks or lead or cast iron or whatever it is trying to make the boat sink all the time. Whereas in the dugout canoe, if the boat is flooded, if the canoe becomes swamped and flooded, there's still enough buoyancy in the upper portions of the log to keep the canoe from sinking, and yet it has ballast. It is the only naturally ballasted, unsinkable surface watercraft that I know of. They can be actually self-rescuing. Ancient people learned that they could unload the boat, hoping that the cargo doesn't sink, and rock the thing from end to end and slosh the water out over the ends of the vessel, enough for a guy to get in there and bail out the rest of it. Everybody climb in, throw the cargo back in, and take off. They were wonderfully technical, advanced, but ancient watercraft. And when fitted with small, low aspect ratio sail plans, that is, sails that did not tend to try to tip the boat over so hard as do our modern rigs and sail plans, these sailing dugouts were marvelously capable of making extended passages, but usually coastal voyages. They were not wisely taken way offshore where they could get caught in big waves and very strong winds. And so, for true offshore seafaring, more stability was needed. And, of course, there are two ways to get stability. One is to make the hull wider, not perhaps as wide for its length as a mixing bowl, but wide enough so that all by itself it would stand up to heeling effort generated by wind pressure in the sails, even in ocean wind and waves. Now, let's just say that our dugout canoe comes from a log that's about 20 feet long and maybe 2 feet in diameter. That means that the boat is about 10 times longer than it is wide. It has what is called, in sailor talk, a slenderness ratio or fineness ratio of 10. Now, that's a very efficient hull form, easy to move its hull through the water. However, it's relatively unstable laterally, side to side. So, it didn't take too long, you know, maybe only several hundred or several thousand years for the ancient people to decide they could take that log into pieces and put it back together in such a way as to make the hole in the water only 5 times as long as it is wide. Let's say with a slenderness ratio of 5, if it was 20 feet long, it would be 4 feet wide. 4 divided into 20 goes 5 times. And even by modern standards, that's still a very efficient hull form. With a slenderness of 5, the thing can get going pretty good. But most monohull vessels that have what's called form stability, that is, the form of the hull is wide enough to make them stable independently without outriggers, that form stability usually takes a ratio of more like 2 or even 3 or 4 times longer than it is wide. Some little dinghies and big barges or scows are only twice as long as they are wide. They'll carry a lot of weight, but it's hard to make them go. And many monohull forms, both ancient and modern, have a slenderness ratio of somewhere between 3 and 4. They're maybe 3 to 4 times longer than they are wide. They get to be quite stable laterally. They'll carry a fairly high heeling sail plan that will push them along at a pretty good speed, so-called hull speed, until they start to pile up a big wave in front and drag a big wave And because those waves are relatively unnaturally close together, they cannot move fast. And so neither can the boat. Practically speaking, hull forms with a slenderness of roughly 3 to 4 and a length of, let's say, 20 feet to even 40 feet, cannot go faster than 5 or 6 knots because the waves that trap them are too heavy and too close together to dynamically be moved faster than that. Now, of course, if the hull is given a form that's not like a bowl but more like a skimming dish and made very light and given lots of power, it can actually climb over the wave ahead of it and skim across the water. It can go like the Dickens, but if the water is rough, it's a spankety spank. These so-called planing hulls are not normally considered to be seagoing configurations. There are some exceptions, of course, and we'll get into that when we start talking about modern lightweight racing monohull vessels. And so, of course, you can see what we're coming to here. In order to relieve the wave-making problem, the hulls can be made long and narrow. Long, skinny hulls don't make waves anywhere nearly as bad as fat, short hulls. And furthermore, long, narrow hulls can slice through the waves instead of skimming over them and going spankety-spank. And so, by making a raft, not of a bundle of logs joined together, but instead using 2 or 3 canoes spaced wide apart. So now, as the water sees each individual hull, it is long and narrow. But because they are joined together wide apart, this wide track configuration achieves very great lateral stability. Such vessels are not great for carrying copper ingots and cannons, but they can surely carry lots of sail, even in trucking winds, and they can carry lightweight cargoes like human beings and their accoutrements. And most of all, they can really move their own holes in the ocean. So there now, that's the fundamental differentiation between monohull and multihull, homespun as it might be. That's the way I understand it.
But hey, Jimmy, you said earlier that there are some racing monohulls that can go faster than some racing multihulls. How can that be?
Well, Christy, you're pushing me into modern vessels a little earlier than I want to go there. But that's true. There are wonderful advances being made in monohull design these days. They are able to make the hull structure so extremely light that their ballast keels, the deep draft, knife-like keels with big lead bombs on the bottom, can be so relatively heavy that these monohulls, when given a very wide skimming dish hull forms, can really stand up to the wind with their sail plans, develop a lot of power, enough power to climb over their own bow waves, and really go like stink, especially off the wind. They can also have at least adequate upwind performance, although with considerable spankety-spank and slam-bang. In truth, these boats are designed expressly for the downwind races. But still, they cannot compete with multihulls of the same ilk, that is, roughly equivalent in size, cost, crew, and the latest technology. Wherever they are allowed to compete, the multihulls hold all of the distance ocean racing records. And the reason for that, as I see it, is that the monohull designers are faced with an insurmountable problem. No matter how light they manage to make the hull and the rig and the whole darned vessel, and how heavy they manage to make the relative weight of the ballast keel, they have still had to add the ballast keel. They have to add weight in order to achieve stability. Multihulls have to add hulls, but they are not nearly as heavy as that huge lead bomb on the bottom of a knife-like deep draft keel. Now, for sure, there are many other levels on which we can compare multi-hull with monohull. And what we really want to get to is the differentiations between the multi-hull types, catamaran, trimaran, and proa. We're going to get there, but we haven't got time in this session, so I want to close with something that's a bit more ethereal. Let's really start from the beginning. What really is a watercraft, anyway? I mean, besides a shell, a vessel of some sort that makes a hole of a certain shape in the surface of the sea. Well, it's a device that allows us land mammals to gain access to the roughly 3/4 of our planet that's covered with water. We have always wanted that access, not just for extracting the abundant animal protein of the sea, but also for the same reason that the chicken crossed the road, you know, to get to the other side of the water. On land, we have often used animals for carrying ourselves and our stuff, transporting this and that here and there, was done by early humans either in their arms or on their backs or with the help of the animals. But the trouble was, and still is, that God or Darwin never made a sailing camel or a sailing ox or a sailing horse. And as I see it, that creature, was left up to man to create. And in that sense, at least, the boat is the most nearly alive thing that a man can create. A boat is so nearly alive, so responsive to its environment, that to some of us at least, it can acquire almost that divine presence on the face of the earth as have all living things. And I think that's especially true of a sailing boat. You know, the atmosphere and the hydrosphere are both in almost constant motion. They each slide across each other at their interface, and the sailing vessel extracts its motive power from that relative movement of the two fluids. Now, there might be birds that swim and fish that fly, but there ain't no sailing critter that can help us carry ourselves and all our stuff all around the oceans of the world. So that when we attempt to gestate such a lifelike being on the earth, I think there's something kind of spiritual about it. I've even come to think of boat ownership as watercraft husbandry. And the sailor now, he holds the reins. He's like a boat drover. And how about boat building? Isn't that sort of watercraft selective breeding? And the watercraft designer now, bless his little ego, I mean, that's like playing boat god.
Good grief. Please forgive him, folks. He's just having fun, and he can't remember if he's repeating himself. I cannot believe it, but his email is saying that some of you wish these capers were longer. Not a chance, that's where I put my foot down. If you really want more of his fervoria, and can make the time to read, check out his books on the website and from Amazon, and there are lots of other information products such as videos, audios and more books, all at www.outrigmedia.com, some of it even comes as free downloads. And hey, Jimmy really likes to respond to your feedback, which is why these three capers, 12, 13 and 14, are all about boat stuff, but if you want him to get back into storytelling, better let him know via email. It's outrig.org@gmail.com. I'll read it to him out loud myself, honest. So bye-bye, from me and the bogus boat god. Amen.